AM 1080 KSCO. Here now is your host for today's program, Ruth Copeland.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Welcome to the show. In case you're a new listener, which I think there might be a few, a bit of background on me. I am British and I've lived in Santa Cruz for over 10 years though, and I'm also an American citizen. I have a professional background in the arts, in music, writing and performance, and also psychotherapy and business. And if you're new to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland, in the first hour we look at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, attempting to see if we have more in common than divides us, focusing on debate rather than one-sided conversations. And we keep a balance between the left and the right brain, with the second hour featuring an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at ruth@ksco.com, ruth@ksco.com. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the show and also any issues that you might want me to cover. And I'll also try to monitor that email address during the show in case you feel like giving your opinion via email as the hour unfolds. So that's ruth@ksco.com. I've got my trusty little iPad down here and I'm going to attempt to multitask if that happens, if some people email. But you can also email us at other times too if you want to contact me. You can also follow me on Twitter and message me there. My Twitter name is at Ruth Copeland, RuthCopland. And you're listening on KSCO AM 1080 and maybe also on the live stream at ksco.com. And I think the live video stream is up today, so if you feel like checking that out on the website, we're sort of beta testing this whole video streaming thing. Eventually we're going to have a whole very extensive setup, but at the moment we're just seeing kind of how it works, what it looks like. So if you want to go and check that out, you can see what I look like with headphones on, etc. Anyway, you can watch the live video stream, I think, from anywhere in the world, and you can listen from anywhere in the world. So wherever you are in America or the world, welcome. And here it's a very strange day to me. It's 77 degrees in the beginning of January. It seems peculiar to be in the middle of winter and it to be so hot, but it is a very beautiful day. We should be grateful for that. But perversely, I really want some rain. I'm really, really missing the rain. So I'm hoping we're going to get some too soon. And also, I think we really need some. The earth really needs some rain. In the second hour today, just after three, I'll be interviewing Nancy Horan, New York Times best-selling fiction author of Loving Frank and Under the Wide and Starry Sky. Her debut novel, Loving Frank, explores the true story behind American architect Frank Lloyd Wright and his lover, Mama Borthwick Cheney. And this book was translated into 16 languages and remained on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year and was awarded the James Fenimore Cooper Prize for Best Historical Fiction, as well as being voted one of the best books of 2007 by the Washington Post and Chicago Tribune, amongst other newspapers. And her eagerly awaited second novel, Under the Wide and Starry Sky, tells the passionate story of Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson of Treasure Island fame and his intrepid American wife, Fanny. And we'll talk about her life, work, and why she likes to write fact as fiction. So I hope you can stay around for that. That's just after 3 o'clock. So what have we got coming up this hour? This week, we are considering who controls the end of life. God, the government, the medical profession, or us? How important is quality of life? And should each individual be able to choose for themselves how and when their life ends? Or should this be mandated by the state? Is euthanasia giving dignity in death to people at the end with no quality of life? Or is it a slippery slope? Should the individual's desire for autonomy trump blanket legislation? Or is it the government's job to preserve life even against the wishes of the individual? What do you think? Join the conversation. If you have any thoughts on this or experiences to share, do call the studio on 831-479-1080. I'd love to hear your comments. And you can also email Ruth at KSCO as well. So, who controls the end of life? This week I came across an issue highlighted by the BBC. The fact that Belgium is divided over whether to legalise euthanasia for terminally ill children. Euthanasia for adults is already legal in Belgium. And I was stunned. I just was thinking, oh, how awful to have to even consider such a thing. And it was brought poignantly to mind for me whilst reading the new novel of my guest of the next hour, Nancy Horan, her book Under the Wide and Starry Sky, based on the life of Robert Louis Stevenson, which contains a tragic account of a five-year-old child suffering terribly for months before finally dying. So it started me thinking about who controls the end of life for us all. For most people, the end of the idea of ending one's own life seems unnatural and abhorrent. But why? Why? It made me really interested to investigate where our feelings and beliefs about this subject come from. I'm not thinking about people who commit suicide due to despair or mental instability or illness. That's a different subject which is deeply poignant in its own way. For the purposes of this show and thinking about who controls the end of life, I'm thinking about the right to choose the end of your life when you are terminally ill and your quality of life is such that you don't want to continue. In this situation, who controls the end of life? Patients can legally end their life by refusing food and medical treatments, but this is often a long and painful process. Is it more compassionate to allow them to die with dignity when they choose, or should nature be allowed to take its course? What do you think? Call the studio on 831-479-1080. I'd be very interested in your comments. And as I said, I'm thinking very specifically for this topic, who controls the end of life, about people who are terminally ill with no hope of recovery and what choice should be given to them in that situation. So I'm not really thinking about other people deciding for somebody who's in a coma or something like that, or, as I said, for people who end their life due to despair, thinking about this very particular situation of when you are terminally ill, you have no quality of life. Should the choice be yours at that point, when and how you leave the world? And many think we should not choose to take our life or help someone to do so for religious reasons. But the medical profession plays God to give life when in many instances the person would die naturally without intervention. And I'm just wondering, is this a dichotomy that it's okay to interfere to prolong life, but it's not okay to interfere and hasten death if we are terminally ill and have no quality of life? And there was a film a few years back called City of Angels, starring Meg Ryan as a heart surgeon and Nicolas Cage as an angel. And I don't know if you saw the film. It's a pretty interesting film. And there's a scene where there's a whole medical team fighting for the life of a heart surgery patient. And afterwards, Meg Ryan, the surgeon, she says something like, "We're always fighting to save someone's life. Do you ever wonder who we're fighting?" And I thought that was very interesting. Who or what are we fighting? If indeed we are, you know, we commonly speak about that. So what do you think? Is prolonging life by medical intervention on the same continuum as using medical means to hasten death in the case of terminal illness? Or are they very different things with different rationales? And if so, what are these? Do call the studio with your thoughts, 831-479-1080, or email me, ruth@ksco.com. And we do have Art in Salinas on the line. Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland Art.
Hi, Ruth. You know, I really had to take a couple deep breaths when I heard this subject you're talking about today because I lost my mom a couple years ago now from a disease, PSP, something that the doctors really don't know a lot about, but it was a degenerative disease where it left her completely helpless for the last 3 years of her life. And it was really sad, you know, but I think it comes down to the final breath being taken. You have to have a lot within yourself. Hopefully, this is where people can see the sanctity of marriage, where you have somebody there with you to help make these decisions as things like this happen. But then you've always got to look at the professional aspects of the doctors, because basically everything that they told me happened, and they were very professional in their manners, which they took place in the care of my mom. And I think you really have to listen to these people. They're paid professionals. They've had a lot of training. They know what to do. They know what's the best. The word euthanization on a human, that is really a scary concept to try to swallow that. But there again, I think, you know, that the doctors know best. You know, if you're going to have your house painted, you hire a professional painter to paint it if you want a good job. Well, if you want your care be done proper, you need to have some kind of medical person to give you the best advice, because they're trained in this field, and it really breaks down into many segments of medicine. But I think for the person himself, they can make things in advance of this situation where they can sign papers letting them know they don't want to be kept on the machine and this and that. But what a subject, you know. It's unbelievable what is in store for all of us at some point.
Yes, I mean, it is a very kind of poignant and deep subject, and I'm really sorry about what happened to your mother. That must have been very distressing for you and for her. It's very sad. And I think you're right, you know, that the medical profession, they can give their opinion, but often in situations where the person is still conscious, you're right, the living will thing, I think, is a very good thing to do. You can give your wishes for how you want your life to go. And I just recently learnt there's something called five wishes as well. That's a form you can fill out through your doctor, which talks about how you would like the end to be, like whether you would like music playing and what people you would like there and things like that. So you can definitely, I think, set things up in advance. But it is a sort of very poignant subject. But what do you think? I mean, obviously, from what you're saying, it sounds like a decision had to be made for your mother. But what do you think about when a person's in a situation when they can still make the decision for themselves? Do you think they should be allowed to do that if that's what they wish?
Yes, I do. You know, in my case, my mom, she had very good health care. With the shame about the whole thing, she worked. I lost my dad at a young age through cancer. So I got hit in a couple of rough blows through my life because of this. And she worked. And then as soon as she retired, this illness came upon her, so she didn't get to enjoy her retirement. Yet she had great health care, where she had the nurse in the home provided for her, this and that, all good in that aspect. But the life, the quality of life just went out the door. And the shame, the thing that's really the shame about it is once we're gone, we are basically forgotten. And I've seen it with my own two eyes. I hear this all the time as an adage. You know, when you're gone, it's just a matter of days where, you know, it's like life. Death brings on life, and it's just part of the whole natural cycle. So you, at some point, you just have to put, you know, buckle down and decide, you know, am I going to sign papers for this at some point in my life if I get in this position, or am I going to be hooked to a machine, you know? And I think it's really nobody's call. It's the preparation you did without your life what's going to lead you into how the end of life's going to, you know, come about.
Yeah, I mean, physician-assisted suicide is actually, that's what they call it, is legal in 4 states in America. So I'm wondering whether you think it should be legal everywhere so that people have the choice if they want to.
Absolutely, I do. I really, you know, when they had Kevorkian, the doctor that did prison time for doing that, you know, if you listen to him and you listen to his patients and the family of those patients, he was doing what they wish. And for them to lock him up in prison, trained doctor, physician for his entire life as a medical You know, I just thought that was crazy. But, you know, every day has something new that's just amazing what goes on. But, you know, I'll let you get your other calls, Ruth. It's a good subject that I want to listen back and see what other people have to say. Because, you know, that was really a gut punch to me when this went down. They did. Yeah, but, you know, you have to, in her wishes, being my mother, she wanted me to continue on. So that's what I'm trying to do. But they can participate on your show. I always look forward to it. So you have a great day.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Art. I always appreciate what you have to say. It's always very insightful. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So I really appreciate Art talking about that. It's obviously a very personal experience to share about this topic. So before Art called, I was sort of asking whether the fact that we allow life to be prolonged by medical intervention is on the same continuum as using medical means to hasten death in the case of terminal illness. Or are these very different things with different rationales? And if so, what are these? And again, if you just have joined us, we're talking about who controls the end of life, but in somewhat specific circumstances. If somebody is terminally ill, their quality of life is low, and they wish to choose when they die, do you think that should be legal or not? So we're not talking about making a decision for somebody else if they're on life support. We're not talking about suicide due to, you know, despair. We're talking very specifically about if you are terminally ill and you really want to control how and when you die, should you be able to do that? Or should the government be able to legislate so that you don't have that individual right to do that? And if you have any thoughts, please do call the studio, 831-479-1080. And you can also email me if you wish, ruth@ksco.com. And you can also email me at that about anything to do with It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. If you have ideas for issues you'd like to be covered, then just let me know. And we have a caller on the line. We have Gordy in Boulder Creek. And I'm just going to have to go to a commercial break now, Gordy. So please do hold on. I'm very interested to hear what you have to say. Join us after these messages. Thank you.
Ahoy! Come sail into success for 2014 at the Aptos and Capitola Soquel Chambers of Commerce Showcase, Sailing into Success, on Thursday, February 20th at the Capitola Mall. Book your ticket now and be a part of this amazing cruise into 2014. Join over 100 other mates aboard the USS Chambers. Register now for the most successful networking and promotional opportunity of the year, where you will be showcased to thousands of people who need your goods and services. All are welcome aboard. Presented by the Valley Yellow Pages at KSCO and KOMY. Sponsored by Aptos Life, Santa Cruz Sentinel, Good Times, Capitola Life, Times Publishing, and Register Pajaronian. Call the Aptos or Capitola Soquel Chambers of Commerce for registration information at 688-1467 or 475-6522. That's 688-1467 or 475-6522. Call today. Don't let your business be left on the dock.
Shaquille O'Neal for Icy Hot.
If you've got pain, you need the patch.
The Icy Hot Patch. Powerful, targeted, fast-acting pain relief that stays put without the mess. Icy to dull the pain, hot to relax it away. In a variety of sizes. From back, shoulders, knees, even arthritis. So you're covered whenever and wherever you hurt. Stop pain right at the source with Icy Hot Patches.
Pain's no match for the Icy Hot Patch.
For temporary topical pain relief, use only as directed.
Hey, I'm very upset with doctors these days. All they want to do is prescribe prescription medication to you that has all these side effects that can kill you or mess you up for life. And of course, you are giving all that money to Big Pharma.
Have you thought about doing alternative methods like aromatherapy?
What is it?
Essential oils and aromatherapy workshop is uniquely designed to open you to the healing arts of essential oils for your health. Our instructor is International Essential Oils and Aromatherapy expert Brenda Wright.
When's the workshop?
Friday, January 24th and Saturday, January 25th in the Santa Cruz, Scotts Valley area. And seating is limited.
Where do I sign up?
Go to the website legacyoils.info. Again, that's legacyoils.info. Or call 1-800-910-1196. Again, that's 1-800-910-1196.
You know, I'm going to sign up right now at legacyoils.info.
This segment brought to you by User Friendly Computing for all your computer service needs. Give them a call today at 423-9653 or stop on by the shop at 505 River Street in Santa Cruz. And be sure to ask Peter for your free $50 diagnostic coupon.
Thanks for listening to AM 1080 KSCO.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And this hour, we are considering who controls the end of life. How important is quality of life? And should each individual be able to choose for themselves how and when their life ends? Or is it the government's job to preserve life even against the wishes of the individual? And if you have any thoughts about this, do call the studio on 831-479-1080. And we have Gordy on the phone, who's been waiting over the break. Thank you very much. Welcome, Gordy.
Good afternoon, Ruth.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I have much to say, probably too much to say about this subject.
Okay.
Very glad you brought this up. First, I'll give you a little bit of my background experience on this. I was married to my wife, who had Huntington's disease, and I watched her slowly decay and demise over a period of about 20 years. The last 10 years, she was institutionalized to varying degrees until the last 4.5 years, where she was permanently institutionalized. For the most part, it was behavior problems, but there was also the physical effects, too.
Mm.
These things affected her spirit deeply.
Mm.
But she hung on to her spirit, and we had discussed these things even before we got married, because we knew she was at risk, as her sister and her aunt were. Aunt, I guess is the way you pronounce it.
Yes.
But anyway, it came time where that decision had to be made. Where a doctor called me at about 3 a.m. and said, look, we can probably revive her again. She had double pneumonia again. And, he wanted my instructions. I could tell that he was, tiptoeing around the tulips here, not being able to be an advocate one way or another, but leaving that decision, up to me and what my wife had, decided, previously. So I gave him the instructions, a simple one, make her as comfortable as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That was my final words. I got the call a couple hours later that she had passed. When I came to visit her, while she was laying there still in rest, for the first time in 20 years, I saw a smile on her face. So I know the decision was a good one. She left contented. Now, other people can say, well, it's the effect of the morphine, it's this and that, but I know what the situation was. Now, with that background in mind, since then, I've also dealt with the situation and helped others going through this process where they chose the other decision, to prolong life as long as possible, keep holding out hope and hope after hope. I'd also taken courses on death and dying at San Jose State. It was a very small class, about 10 or 12 people in there. It's a subject that people don't think about until it's too late. And then under emotional duress, they have to immediately come up with these decisions, or so they think. I think that a lot of this is driven by this impulse to control. And certainly the government has no control over the situation at all. although politically and professionally they want to put up this strong front that we're in charge, we can handle any situation, we indeed are in control. But when it comes to dying, nobody is really in control except the person that's going through that process. Mm-hmm. And therein lies the authority for the decision for that person to make their own choice. It gets very complicated sometimes when people haven't seriously, rather than just off the cuff, you know, in casual conversation, exhibiting what their wishes are when they're in that condition. But it's very important for people to discuss these seriously and to get things in writing. It's always very important to get things in writing. Mm-hmm. I think you may know a little bit about my situation, but it was about 5 years ago. When I thought what was just a minor little tumor on my back, well, it turned out to be a life-threatening situation. I did recover from the operation, what they called remarkable surgery, at the VA hospital with Stanford doctors attending. And during that process, before I even went down to have the operations, I filled out these forms, which expressed what my wishes were. If I was incapacitated, I couldn't make decisions for myself, what the varying severity of the physical conditions were, and so forth. It was a very simple one-page double-sided form that I filled out, and I was able to be at rest mentally, not having to worry about what would happen after afterwards, you know, whether I lived or I didn't live through that process. And I was also able to come to terms with my own spirituality, which I found for myself was the most important thing. If I had that spirit with me, no matter what the course lay ahead of me, I was okay with that. I was able to let go and follow whichever, you know, path, you know, lay before me. But these are many things that people need to discuss, and I'm certainly glad you're bringing this up as an article for discussion publicly over the airwaves. These are things that people need to think about. There's two very important things in our life. One is how we live our life, and the other is how we're going to die. Yeah. And if we have that choice, we need to make those decisions now before you're not able to communicate, you know, what your thoughts are.
Well, firstly, I want to say, Gordy, I'm terribly sorry, you know, to hear about what happened with your wife. Huntington's is a very, very distressing, cruel
disease. It was my life, though. Yeah. My life. I made that decision. So I don't ask for anybody's pity on that.
No,
sometimes people don't realize that you have got yourself into, you know, a difficult situation deliberately. This is your life. This is what you're here on this earth for, is to go through these things. And what happens in the next world, if you carry those memories forward and your experiences forward and what you've learned on this earth. So for me personally, I love the difficult challenge. I want to test myself, especially spiritually and mentally and intellectually. Mm-hmm. Those are things that I crave for, even though they may be detrimental to my physical being. But my physical being is not long-lasting. It's those other things that are long-lasting, the intangible things, those things that other people and governments cannot control.
Yeah. So, Gordy, I want to ask you, I mean, what you're discussing is a situation where somebody expresses their wishes in advance, and then they, you know, when they can't ask themselves, you know, they're allowed to die. But what do you think about if somebody is still coherent, they're terminally ill, their quality of life is very low, they're in pain? Do you think that person should be able to choose to increase their morphine and to die or not? Because at the moment that's illegal. It's illegal for someone to choose to do that in 46 states, and it's illegal for a doctor to help them do that.
Yeah, okay. Now what is illegal within, you know, our legal system here is one thing. What really goes on out there in the medical world especially is something else. There are get-arounds, if you know what I mean, where that technically you're complying with the law, but you're certainly not complying with the so-called spirit of the law. This goes on every day at almost every hospital in this country, where through whether maybe a mistake in the overdose of medication is deliberately, you know, contrived.
Yeah. But do you think though that it should be allowed to be a conscious thing rather than it be a get around? I mean, we're very prominent about wanting our rights in America. Do you think
in the ideal world, yes, I agree.
Okay. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't live in the ideal world, so
we
must very, very carefully here. As you can see, scenarios where somebody says, well, they said they wanted to die,
yes.
but who knows that? You know, it's a very
tricky,
precarious waters that you get into there.
Yeah.
I don't know the answers. The only thing that I know is that it is ultimately an individual decision, and I see forces of control wanting to control that, just like everything humans do.
Yeah.
We want to control, and we also, and here's a very important one that comes later, assigning blame.
Right.
That is what a lot of people do, whether maybe everybody's blameless, maybe everybody's to blame, but there's this impulse for people to blame. But this is a natural event that really nobody has any control over. We can only assist one way or the other at best. Those are some of my thoughts.
Well, I really appreciate you calling in, Gordy. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you bringing this subject up again. I hope some other people have some answers that I haven't found that will call you up too.
Well, I have Crystal, who's been waiting patiently on the phone, so we'll see what Crystal has to say. But I really appreciate you sharing your experiences and your thoughts on this, Gordy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. So if you just joined us, we're talking about who controls the end of life. How important is quality of life? And should each individual be able to choose for themselves how and when their life ends if they have a terminal illness and their quality of life is very poor? Or is it the government's job to preserve life even against the wishes of the individual? If you have any thoughts on this, please do call the studio 831-479-1080. And we're going to go to Crystal now, who's in her car. And thank you so much for waiting so patiently. You're on It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Hi. I just took a class in end of life.
Uh-huh.
And everything I read, I don't think we're going to have to worry about the government stepping in to prevent death. Everything I learned and read is the government's going to push us towards death. They're going to make it so that if you can't contribute to society anymore, sir, you're going to be put on, there's three different categories that they'll put you on until you die. So I don't think the government is going to intercede and say, no, you can't. What they're going to do is be pushing you towards that.
Okay, so you've said that you'll be put in three different categories, did you say?
Yes, there are three different stages that they can put you in. There's the critical ill, the terminally ill, and no hope of ever redoing it.
Right.
And then there's ones that can live a healthy life or whatever, prolonged life. But it's uncomfortable, so and then they've got one that is undetermined, the third stage called justifying, I'm trying to remember the word they used. But I don't think we're going to have to worry about the government overseeing and saying, no, we can't do this.
Okay, well, currently it is illegal in 46 states. It's only legal in 4 states. But what would be the motivation of the government wanting to help people on?
What they do is they keep you comfortable and give you medications to help you that will bring on your death. It's not helping you die, but they don't put it that way. They put it is that they are they help make you comfortable to get there, that anything they give you may hasten your death.
Right. So I'm wondering where you took this class and who sponsored it, who was running it.
It was through an adult education course.
Oh,
I have to take continued education for my certificate.
Okay. Are you a therapist?
I'm a CNA.
Ah, I see. Okay. What would be the motivation of the government wanting to hasten somebody's death?
you get they're not productive. They're not able to contribute to the society, and there's no more money coming into them. They're paying out for them.
But aren't they generating money into the economy, into the medical profession? Because if they're being cared for medically, then somebody's being paid and earning money for them being kept alive, because that's what some people cynically think, is that people are kept alive forever so that people can make money.
They may not be. They may be on Medicare, Medi-Cal. They may be indigent. They can't pay for anything. So, I mean, this is what they're doing. But on top of everything, you're talking about having advanced directives and going into hospitals and all that. We had a situation where we had an advanced directive, and we had to pull out of the hospital in order for them to follow the advanced directive, because they would not follow the advanced directive. We were accused of interfering with doctor-patient relations. The papers were all signed. I was power of attorney. I was told that I couldn't intercede. They were, and I had to pull the paperwork out and say, this is what her advanced directive said.
Yeah.
And they would not honor her advanced directive.
I mean, I think it's a difficult area. I mean, people don't want to be held liable, possibly being accused of having killed someone or whatever. But I also think I brought this point up earlier that's quite interesting, that, you know, people are very keen to not sort of interfere and end someone's life. But the medical profession intervenes all the time to prolong life when, if just left to nature, people would die. And so the argument of not interfering seems a bit spurious in some cases, that it's just being used in one case but not another. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I think if they're terminally ill and there's no hope of them forever being, having a quality of life, and they're just lying in bed and you're, doing nothing, then they have the right to say yes or no.
Yeah, I mean, it seems obviously that it should lie with the individual, because some people may want to continue like that. Certainly, we wouldn't want a situation like you're suggesting, where it's decided you're no longer productive. I read somewhere a long time ago that there was a tribe in Africa that when the people got too old and were unproductive, they used to take them and leave them out on the veldt, and they would just be picked off by wild animals. So I think, we don't want a situation where other people are deciding if our life has value or quality, but there is an argument that we should be able to decide that for ourselves and not be forced to continue if we don't think our life is worth living.
It's really, especially if they've got dementia, Alzheimer's, they have no quality of life. They're laying in their bed. They have, I see it on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I mean, I don't know if advanced directives can cover that, because sadly people with dementia and Alzheimer's often are very physically fit, so they're unlikely to die of natural causes. So that, I think that's a whole other area. I was trying, there's a lot of different areas with this topic, so I was trying to keep it at when the person is conscious, when they can decide for themselves, when they're terminally ill, there's no hope of living, just to sort of think of that situation.
Some of them are that way, and they're terminally ill, they're laying in their bed, and they can't make the decision.
Why not?
Because the medical facilities is gone. They have no. They have the mind of a 2-year-old.
Oh, I see.
How are you going to deal with the mind of a 2-year-old?
Yeah.
And have them make an objective decision whether to end their life or not.
Yeah. Well, in that case. Yeah. In that case, I guess it would have to be the advanced directive, because I don't think you can have a situation where if they've never expressed any wishes that they wish to die in those circumstances, that they should be, effectively their life ended. But maybe an advance directive could help with that. But as you, shared with us, that doesn't always work. Sometimes that's very complicated legally. Well, I really appreciate you calling in, Crystal. I need to go to a commercial break now, but I hope you might call into the show again, and I really appreciate your thoughts on this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Enjoy.
Enjoy chocolate of all types at the 6th Annual Santa Cruz Chocolate Festival, Sunday, January 19th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Coconut Grove on the Beach Boardwalk. Sponsored by the UCSC Women's Club, proceeds support re-entry student scholarships at UCSC. Enjoy the silent auction, wine tasting, the Santa Cruz Derby Girls, and cupcake decorating. For more information, check santacruzchocolatefestival.org.
Dale here from Jungle Plant. I thought it was time for you all to hear about the great interior plant service we provide.
Hi, this is Amanda from Office Club in Capitola. Jungle Plant has provided our office with beautiful plants and has given us reliable service for the past year. We are so happy that we found affordable plant maintenance that is perfect for our needs.
So give us a call at 462-5806, 462-5806, or visit us at jungleplant.com.
Ben Lomond Market. Low price, great savings, quality, and service that doesn't always cost you more.
Andy Gustafson. My job is the produce manager at Ben Lomond Market. I do all the ordering, quality control, bringing in new items, making sure everything is nice out on the rack for the customer to buy. I have worked here 25 years. I personally love the customers we have. I love working for the owners I have. And between comparing those two together, it's a real easy, nice, fun job. My favorite is apples. Any kind of apple, I love eating apples. My favorite vegetable is probably Italian squash. We have plenty of fresh product, both in produce, meat, deli. We have, I think, a very warm crew, and we really try to make the customer happy. We really appreciate our customers.
Ben Lomond Market, compare and save.
A proud member of Think Local First, Santa Cruz County.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Costa, host of the Costa Report. I don't know if you feel a little sluggish in the middle of the afternoon like I do, but if you do, I'm going to suggest you try Pollen Burst. It's an orange-flavored energy drink that comes in a packet, and it tastes a lot like that other orange drink the astronauts used to drink. You know the one. Pollen Burst contains vitamins A, B1, B3, B6, B12, pantothenic acid, vitamin D3, and gluconolactone, all designed to give you an energy boost that can last for hours. Pollen Burst comes in a box of 30 packets for $56 or two boxes for $100, and you can order it right now at KSCOteam.com. The next time you feel tired and need a little boost, skip the coffee, soda, or candy bar and mix up a cold glass of Pollen Burst and do your body some real good. Go to KSCOteam.com.
You're listening to KSCO, serving Aromas, the Carmel Highlands, and Paraiso Springs.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And coming up after three, I have a guest today, novelist Nancy Horan. So I hope you can stay around and hear my interview with her. She's got a wonderful new book out, Under the Wide and Starry Sky, which is based on the life of Robert Louis Stevenson. So I'm really looking forward to talking to her. That'll be after the news, just after three. And in this hour, we've been talking about who controls the end of life. How important is quality of life? And should each individual be able to choose for themselves how and when their life ends? Or is it the government's job to preserve life even against the wishes of the individual? And if you have any thoughts on this, please do call the studio on 831-479-1080. And I also want to let you know that if you want to contact me, you can email ruth@ksco.com. If you have any thoughts about the show or issues that you would like me to cover. And looking back at history, it's interesting to see what views were held at different times about euthanasia. And in ancient Greece and Rome, before the coming of Christianity, attitudes toward infanticide, active euthanasia, and suicide had tended to be tolerant. And many ancient Greeks and Romans had no defined belief in the inherent value of individual human life. And although the Hippocratic Oath prohibited doctors from giving a deadly drug to anybody, not even if asked for, or from suggesting such a course of action, few ancient Greek or Roman physicians followed the oath faithfully. And throughout classical antiquity, there was widespread support for voluntary death as opposed to prolonged agony. And physicians complied by often giving their patients the poisons they requested. With the advent of Christianity, the concept of ending one's own life was rigorously decried. It was believed that taking one's own life was a sin because it's self-murder, and murder is prescribed by God. And this is a derived notion of Christian theology. And by the 12th to the 15th centuries in the Christian world, the idea that life is held in trust from God culminated in the near unanimity of medical opinion in opposing euthanasia. And sciencemusings.com states, in the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas espoused Catholic teaching about suicide in arguments that would shape Christian thought about suicide for centuries. Aquinas condemned it as wrong because it contravenes one's duty to oneself and the natural inclination of self-perpetuation, because it injures other people in the community of which the individual is a part, and because it violates God's authority over life, which is God's gift. But do these arguments apply in the case of someone who is terminally ill with no quality of life? And what if you don't share these religious beliefs? Should you be subject to a law that may be based on precepts that you don't adhere to? And currently in America, physician-assisted suicide, which is choosing to end your life if you are terminally ill, is illegal in 46 states. It's only legal in 4 states, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and Massachusetts. So we're looking at here who controls the end of life. Is it us? Is it God? Is it the government? Is it the medical profession? And as I mentioned earlier, looking at a very specific example, because this is a wide topic, of when someone is terminally ill with no quality of life, should they have the right to be able to choose how and when they die? And an argument that's often used by those who support euthanasia for the terminally ill is that we decide for compassionate reasons that suffering animals be put out of their misery. So why do we not have the same choice for ourselves? What do we consider to be different in the case of humans? Are we holding ourselves to higher standards than animals, or is it something else? Let me know what you think. You can call on 831-479-1080. And an argument that's often used by those who oppose euthanasia is that it's a slippery slope, that allowing a person to choose to end their life in certain limited circumstances even, such as when they are terminally ill with no quality of life, could lead to a more widespread use of euthanasia. And these opponents fear that euthanasia could take on a sinister aspect, which I think is somewhat what Crystal, our caller, Crystal, who just called, was referring to, where people are pressured perhaps to end their lives when they don't want to, or even being helped out of the world without their permission for reasons of utility. So I'm just wondering what you think. Is this far-fetched paranoia, or is it a real concern? And can we create legislation that actually controls this to a high enough degree that we can give people that right? And in Massachusetts, for example, physicians are only able to assist in ending life with a court order. So there's a fairly rigorous process that has to be gone through. The person has to be fully cognizant of what's going on, agree they have to be terminally ill. The family has to agree. I think there's all kinds of parameters. So it does seem that in these instances, it could be controlled so that it isn't abused. But I'm wondering what you think about that. Should each individual be able to choose for themselves how and when their life ends, or should this be mandated by the state? If you have any thoughts, call 831-479-1080 or email me, ruth@ksco.com. And another interesting thought that occurred to me when thinking about this debate is from the religious perspective, is that a lot of religions are vehement against people deciding to take their own lives, but have done a lot of mental gymnastics to make it okay for life to be ended in other circumstances, such as in war or capital punishment. So I'm just wondering if there's an inconsistency there. And our ideas about euthanasia in America are largely based upon Christian thought. But I also was wondering, what do religions other than Christianity think about ending one's own life? And in Buddhism, for instance, compassion is one of the ruling precepts, and some Buddhists use this as a justification for euthanasia because the suffering person is relieved of pain. However, it is still considered wrong to destroy human life, although the Dalai Lama has said that it is best to judge this on a case-by-case basis. And Hinduism was interesting. They have two views within Hinduism. One is that by helping to end a painful life, a person is performing a good deed and so fulfilling their moral obligations. And on the other hand, by helping to end a life, even one filled with suffering, a person is disturbing the timing of the cycle of death and rebirth, and that this could result in some karma remaining for the patient. And it's clearly stated in the Vedas, which are the ancient teachings of the East, 5,000 to 7,000 years old. They say that man has only two trusty friends in life. The first is called Vidya, knowledge, and the second is called Mrityu, death. The former is something that is beneficial and a requirement in life, and the latter that is something that is inevitable, sometimes even unexpected. But they do say that it is permitted to end your life with the hope of reaching moksha, which is the emancipation of the soul. So that was interesting, some different views there of what it might mean to choose to end one's own life. And we're coming to the end of the show, so I want to say thank you so much for the callers who called in today, sharing some very poignant experiences. That must have been fairly emotional to remember, and I certainly felt privileged to share those experiences, as I'm sure other listeners did. So thank you very much for those calls. Just to remind you again, after 3 o'clock, we're going to be interviewing Nancy Horan, New York Times bestselling fiction author of Loving Frank and Under the Wide and Starry Sky. Her debut novel was incredibly successful, translated into 16 languages on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. So we'll be talking to her about her life, work, and why she likes to write fact as fiction. So keep it here on It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz. Join me after the break.
AM 1080 KSCO. Once again, here's your host, Ruth Copland.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And if you're new to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland, in the first hour, we look at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, attempting to see if we have more in common than divides us, focusing on debate rather than one-sided conversations. And we keep a balance between the left and right brain with the second hour, featuring an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. And if you'd like to contact me, you can email ruth@ksco.com. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the show and any issues you might want me to cover. And you can also follow me on Twitter and message me there. My Twitter name is @RuthCopland. And my guest this week is Nancy Horan, New York Times best-selling fiction author of Loving Frank and Under the Wide and Starry Sky. Her debut novel, Loving Frank, explores the true story behind American architect Frank Lloyd Wright and his lover, Mama Borthwick Cheney. And it was translated into 16 languages, remained on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year, and was awarded the James Fenimore Cooper Prize for Best Historical Fiction, as well as being voted one of the best books of 2007 by the Washington Post and Chicago Tribune, amongst other newspapers. And her eagerly awaited second novel, Under the Wide and Starry Sky, tells the passionate love story of Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson and his intrepid American wife, Fanny. And a native Midwesterner, Nancy was a teacher and a journalist before turning to fiction writing. She lived for 25 years in Oak Park, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, where she raised her two sons. And she now lives with her husband on an island in Puget Sound. Welcome to the show, Nancy. So where are you right now? Where are we talking to you from?
Well, I live on an island called Whidbey Island, which is north of Seattle, and I'm in my home, and I'm getting ready for a book tour right now.
Right, and I understand you're going to be in our area soon. You're in San Francisco on the 22nd and 23rd of January, so I want to let listeners know, if you're interested, you can go to Nancy. Now, is it Horan or Horan?
Horan.
Okay, so the first hour I was saying it incorrectly with my English accent. So it's Nancy Horan, Horan.com. If you go there, you can find out the whole of her book tour dates. So I would suggest that you do that. That would be great. And for the benefit of listeners not familiar with your career, I'm wondering if you could tell us how you came to start writing, Nancy.
Well, I had had a number of careers before I started writing. I really came to writing later in my life. I had been a teacher first, and then I had worked in the corporate world, and then I worked as a journalist for a while, and that's really where my writing began. I worked as a freelancer for the Chicago Tribune, and I began by doing journalism, and in time, I took a couple of fiction writing classes and really enjoyed it. And quite by accident, I came upon the story, a little-known chapter in Frank Lloyd Wright's life that was amazing to me, and I decided to fictionalize it based on the real history and tell the story of Wright's relationship with one of his clients.
Right. Yes. Oh, that's very... very interesting. You are breaking up a little bit, Nancy. Let's see if we can get a better connection. Thank you.
Good.
So we're talking to Nancy Horan. I've now got her name correctly pronounced, so that's good. She started to talk about her first book, Loving Frank, which is about the architect Frank Lloyd Wright and his clandestine love affair with Mama Borthwick Cheney. And her husband, Edwin, Mama's husband, Edwin, commissioned the renowned architect to design a new home for them. And during the construction, a powerful attraction developed between Mama and Frank. And in time, the lovers, each married with children, embarked on a course that would shock Chicago society and forever change their lives. And while scholars have largely relegated Mama to a footnote in the life of America's greatest architect, Nancy Horan has given full weight to their dramatic love story and illuminates Cheney's profound influence on Wright. And obviously, Nancy does an incredible amount of research with her books. I'm currently reading her new novel, Under the Wide and Starry Sky. I haven't finished it yet, but it's beautifully imagined, and the historical detail is just wonderful. So I'm sure that Loving Frank, considering how popular it was, is also full of the same kind of beautiful writing and meticulous detail. And she's choosing people, obviously, that spark something in her, and perhaps people whose stories are not as well known as some other people that we might be aware of. And the new book, as I mentioned earlier, is based on the life of Robert Louis Stevenson, and it certainly made me want to read some Robert Louis Stevenson again, because it gets inside his head. I had really no knowledge about his wife and her life, and they go through some incredibly challenging experiences, but what they get out of that is really remarkable, really remarkable. So I really do recommend both these books. And if you are interested in finding out more about Nancy, as we said before, you can go to nancyhoran.com, find out about her work and also her talk book and signings that are coming up in our area, the San Francisco, but she's going all around the country. So we're going to go back to Nancy now, and apparently it's still not a great connection, but we're going to try.
Well, Nancy, Ruth, I'm hearing you better.
Oh, no, that sounds hugely better to me.
Good, I'm on a cell phone. So let's have a go at it.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I can actually really hear what you're saying now. You don't sound like a robot. So that's a great improvement.
Wonderful.
So I was just trying to fill people in a little bit about your first book and your second book. So I'm going to go and ask you... what makes you want to write fact as fiction rather than straight fiction or biography? What's appealing about that to you?
Well, you know, I have to say that with the first book, it was really an issue of my bumping into an astonishing story. And it was a story that people didn't know, and it was factual. And it grabbed me and shook me and wouldn't leave me alone. And I thought, why has this story not been told? And it occurred to me that it could be told. There were many gaps in the story, and it occurred to me that it could be told in a fictional way. And as a writer, I could attempt to empathize with the characters and explore what was going on inside the heads of these two people when they made the choices they made and faced the consequences that followed.
Are you talking about both books in this instance or one book in particular?
I am talking at the moment about the first book I wrote, which was Loving Frank.
Right.
That was my first experience with writing factual material, historical material, as fiction. So I like very much having the structure of real history, historical, agreed-upon facts, as a structure in which I can work and look at some of the whys. Why did these people do what they did? And sometimes there's not an obvious answer, but what I like to do is draw my own conclusions, line up those facts, line up those conditions that existed at the time that they embarked on their journey together, and make my own conclusions. And just as a biographer would or a historian would look at the facts and try to figure out why something happened, I'm doing that as well, but I'm doing it as a person who's writing fiction about it.
So presumably, as you are writing it as fiction, it enables you to fill in any gaps and imagine what might have happened, or to imagine how they were feeling, but with the basis of your historical research to ground that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what's happening. And I look at what kind of background that person comes from, what kind of environment, what's the cultural environment is like at the time, where that person is living, all the forces that are bearing down on that character. And in the case of Mae Machini with the first book, and certainly with the second book with Fanny Osborne, I am working from the inside as well as the outside, certainly with Lewis Stevenson in the second book as well. You know, I use the historical facts to build the outside of the story, the part that's obvious to me. And then I have to go inside myself to imagine what it is like, for example, in the case of Fanny Osborne, to be married to a husband who is sort of a serial philanderer. Hmm. He's regularly unfaithful to her, and there comes a point in her life when she decides she can't bear it anymore and she needs to leave, and she takes her children with her to Europe to study art. It's 1875, and it was one of the ways in which a woman could, a respectable woman could leave an unhappy marriage at that time. And so she went for a year and she took her children. They started off and they went to Antwerp. But really, she was running as much as she was going to Europe.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a commercial break right now, but keep it here. I'm talking to best-selling novelist Nancy Horan. So join us after this break. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland on KSCO AM 1080. Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland and my guest of this hour, Nancy Horan. And we've been talking about her two books, her best-selling book, Loving Frank, and her new book, Under the Wide and Starry Sky. And as we have the video live stream on, I'm just going to hold up her book here for any of you who are watching the video live stream. It's a beautiful cover. It's got the picture of the profile of a woman in a beautiful dark blue and pale blue night sky. So for any of you watching the video, you can see that. And I am about a quarter of the way through it. It's a really beautiful book. I'm really enjoying it. It's keeping me up at night. So I would I would suggest listeners check it out. And if you want to meet Nancy in person, you can go to her website, nancyhoran.com, and check out her book tour. She's in San Francisco, 22nd and 23rd of January. So you can find out about that if you'd like to get a book signed and meet her. So before the commercial break, we were just talking a bit about Under the Wide and Starry Sky, which is the story of Robert Louis Stevenson and his wife, eventually his wife, Fanny, and about how she went to Paris to try and get away from a philandering husband. And really, at that time, you were saying that was the only way you could sort of respectfully leave your husband, which seems madness, doesn't it, really, when he was just being so awful, having all these prostitutes and everything.
Right, exactly. It was probably not the only way you could leave a husband. You could probably divorce a husband, but the price you would pay could be devastating for a family, because she had no source of income, and he was willing to support her for a year away from him, and so she took that window of opportunity and she left.
Yeah.
So she did go to Paris, and she and something happened in Paris, which I'd prefer not to reveal. But she was with her children. She was studying art and loving it. She was at an atelier where it was run by a French art instructor named Monsieur Julien, and he had classes for women artists. So Fanny and her teenage daughter attended classes, and they had a nanny who watched the other two children. And they began to really settle into a routine in Paris and the life of a woman artist in Paris, which was pretty marvelous, I guess. And then a tragedy hit Fanny's little family there, and they had to leave Paris. Fanny was devastated by her loss, and they went on doctor's orders. She went to a small town in France called Grez-sur-Loing, and it had a hotel there, the Hotel Chevillon, where she would stay. She ended up staying with her children there, and she was really attempting to recover from a terrible blow. And at the hotel, she met a crowd of artists who had come there. They were bohemian young artists who came there to work together and enjoy, drink wine and eat together and have a good time. And eventually, one of the people who came to see his friends there was Robert Louis Stevenson. He was 26 years old. He was at the very beginning of his writing career. And Fanny was 10 years older than he. She was 36. They were from different worlds. And they met and they fell in love there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. And reading it, it seems there must be a daunting amount of research involved to write a book like this. I'm thinking you must have to be really interested in your subject to contemplate that.
I love the research part of it. But, you know, at some point you have to turn away from the research and really just immerse yourself and respond to the demands of writing a novel, which are quite different from doing the research. But
I do love the research part of it, and I did experience just a wonderful time traveling to the places that Robert Louis Stevenson and Fanny lived. Edinburgh, where Stevenson grew up, he was Scottish. The different places in France, in Paris and Grace Lelouing, and then also they lived in Yerres in the south of France. Certainly they lived in England together. They did eventually marry. And there's a whole story, you know, that, that involves, the area, around Monterey.
Because, oh, interesting.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's a whole connection to California for Robert Louis Stevenson that I didn't really know about.
No.
And that is how I came to write this book. I'll tell you, I learned that Robert Louis Stevenson had lived in Monterey, California. And I thought, well, what was he doing there? What was he doing there? I mean, I learned of it because I became interested in the fact that there was a beach called China Beach, which is near Aptos, and I was interested in that. And when I started reading about the Chinese in California, I discovered that Robert Louis Stevenson had been writing about them in 1879. I thought, well, what is he doing there? Well, it turned out that after having a wonderful, loving relationship with Fanny Osborne for 2 years in France, she returned to her husband. And it was understood between Fanny and Louis that she would seek a divorce from her husband, and yet when she returned to America, her resolve wavered somewhat. Perhaps she worried about breaking up her family, but the plan for a divorce seemed to slow down, and Robert Louis Stevenson waited for a whole year in anguish, waiting for something to happen, some progress to occur. And when he felt that it wasn't happening, and he and Fanny got in touch with him, and it sounded like she was in distress, he decided to come to America. And so he did this amazing big trip. He went from England by ship. He was going to travel in steerage, but by buying access to a little table, he got second class accommodations, although it was really steerage. And he came across, and then he took a train.
Wow.
From New Jersey to Monterey, California.
Yeah, it's an amazing love story, you know, how they just clicked together. And I was wondering, is they're real people? Do you feel any responsibility to portray them as accurately as possible to real life, or is your approach looser, sort of taking artistic license and using their lives just as a base?
I have to say I feel responsibility to them. I mean, you know, when you're talking about someone's personal life, for me, I mean, I think you can do historical fiction in many different ways and many legitimate different ways. But for me personally, I just find it more interesting to go with the facts as they're known and to try to portray these people as close to how they were remembered by other people and how they saw themselves as I can. I enjoy doing that. Now, sometimes it's not very easy to do that. Stevenson really chronicled how he was feeling in the different letters he wrote all through his life. Fanny was not so easy to unlock. But plenty was written about her, so I could construct her personality.
Right, I see. And, you know, that sort of time period and for quite a long time after that, people wrote letters sort of prolifically, didn't they? And that's really helpful. I'm not sure, you know, people in the future looking at our emails now would get the same sort of insight into us as you get from reading people's letters.
I agree with you. I think we've lost something, especially if for the researchers 100 years from now. I don't know how they'll do going through emails, they'll even be able to. But it's a different world. But for somebody like me who's, you know, I went to UC Berkeley to read Fanny's unpublished letters. Stevenson's letters are published, and so that was easier to get to and sort of respond to. But with Fanny, it was, and of course her voice would change a bit depending upon whom she was writing to. So,
right, yeah, cool.
At some point, you have to make some assumptions and make your best guess.
Yes.
About what was happening.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to Nancy Horan about her new book, Under the Wide and Starry Sky, which is a historical novel about the life of Robert Louis Stevenson and his wife, Fanny. And their story brings up quite a lot of issues to do with women's rights and the expectations of women from society at the time. I'm wondering how much that aspect drew you to writing the book.
Well, it's interesting. I write about the women in these books as I find them in their own time. And in the first book, we had Mae Mazzini, who was college educated. She was 29 years younger than Fanny. So in the span of really only 30 years, basically, things had changed enough that Mama was able to go to college, and she got a master's degree, and she became a translator for a Swedish feminist, and she was herself a feminist.
Wow.
Fanny was not.
No.
Fanny was not. Fanny was born in 1840. She married when she was 17 years old in 1857. She was from Indianapolis. She was an independent young woman, very bright, had had a high school education, married a young man with a college education, which was probably quite unusual then.
Yeah.
But the point is that she had the qualities that many wonderful pioneer women had, because Fanny eventually followed her husband to California, where he was mining for gold and silver. And so in following him, she had many adventures just getting to California, because, of course, trains didn't go all the way across the country then. She had to take a ship. She had to travel from Indianapolis to New York, take a ship down the Atlantic coast, cross the Isthmus of Panama by a train, then take a ship up to San Francisco. It was a different world. And so she had a lot of grit. She was game for adventure. She was very adventurous, very strong, and inventive in terms of how she survived in mining camps. I mean, this is a woman who could make furniture out of old boards and logs.
So
she was a different kind of woman. So when she talked about women's rights, which were, that whole movement was stirring at that time, Fanny said, I believe in women's rights in general, but I don't know what women activists would think of me, because they might think I'm a clinging vine. I prefer the company of a man. I hate to think of the great strong oak tree that stands alone and has no shelter for it. She really actually talked about this issue. Now, her daughter, who came along after her 18 years later, she was much more involved in the suffrage movement and that sort of thing, but not Fanny.
No. I mean, I think what I meant was really, but just by seeing, reading about her life, for instance, how she goes to the Antwerp Art School and can't get in because they don't take women, and they're like, oh, if only you were a man, that readers get a sense of, a reminder of, although we still have quite a long way to go, I think, with women's rights, that we have come a long way. And it's just so peculiar to think that we were ever in that place, really, where you couldn't be anything just because you were a woman. So I was just wondering if
you're right,
highlighting those sort of aspects, you know, making sure people don't forget that might have been, you know, something that interested you.
Well, it does interest me, but I, as I said, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I find it astonishing. And yet, you know, and we have come so far, of course, but, you know, it's at the same time, you look at what Fanny was doing. She was she couldn't divorce her husband. She felt when she left him, because she would have no, you know, she would be impoverished by it.
Yeah.
How many women today do you know who fear divorce? Because divorce can impoverish
yep.
a woman.
Yeah, it's true.
So
yeah.
certain things resonate with contemporary readers as, you know, still having some truth in them today for their
yeah.
own lives.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And one of the things I was also interested in, it highlights how difficult it is to pursue art as a career that sustains one financially. And, of course, that's still an issue today, you know, how one is a true creative artist and make, you know, make a living from that.
Right, I agree. And you see in the book, you see Stevenson's struggle. He was a literary athlete. He was his work was prolific. I mean, he wrote 13 novels, something like 13 novels, many, many short stories, poetry, dramas, fables, music. He was
amazing.
Hugely gifted, and he worked continually, and it was a real struggle for a long time for them.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'm talking to Nancy Horan and about her book Under the Wide and Starry Sky and her first book, Loving Frank. And again, I want to just send you to her website, nancyhoran.com. You can find out about the books and also the tour dates in San Francisco on the 22nd and 23rd. And the one on the 22nd is in St. Helena, and the one on the 23rd is in Corte Madera. I think I've pronounced that correctly. But if you go to the website, you can find out that information and get to meet Nancy. And she's be giving a talk, I think, yes, at both those venues. So I would suggest you do go along. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but do join us afterwards to continue hearing more about Under the Wide and Starry Sky. You got it here? It's A Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. I'm with my guest, Nancy Horan, the historical author, best-selling author of Loving Frank. We're talking about her new book, Under the Wide and Starry Sky. And Nancy, you've quoted Stevenson saying, everybody sooner or later sits down to a banquet of consequences. And you've said you're interested in how the characters arrive at the banquet and how they deal with the results of their choices. I was wondering if you're doing this through your research, your imagination, or a combination of both.
Well, I think that quote, which is attributed to Stevenson, there's some question about whether he actually ever said it, but I love the quote so much.
Yeah, it's a great quote,
isn't it? I use it. It's a great quote, and it seems to resonate with everybody when they hear it. But, you know, for me it resonates because I think that's why I love looking at real history.
Right.
And sort of looking at things that happened and what were the consequences of the choices. Looking at Robert Louis Stevenson's choice to take that journey across America and go seek the hand of Fanny Osborne. And he wins. He does it. And they embark on this amazing journey together because he had such bad lungs. He came from Edinburgh, which was it was called Old Reekie, which was Reekie is the Scots word for smoke. And with the industrial pollution and fog and those things combined, it was very bad for him as a child, and he had inherited weak lungs to begin with. So you know, that journey across America, he became very ill and nearly died. That is one of the consequences of deciding to go on that journey. Fanny decided to nurture him back to health in any way she could. And so they go on, and their whole life really together for 18 years is a quest for a place where they can find a place where Lewis can live and breathe better than he does in England and in Scotland, and they live all over the world. So, you know, along the way, you can see the choices they made, good and bad, and you can see how hurtful some of those choices were and how important and right some of those choices were. They ended up in Samoa, in the Pacific, South Pacific, and they had a relationship that I think it was a long marriage, and like a long marriage was complicated. They were very different people to start with. It has moments of euphoria, and sometimes it was very thorny and difficult. And I think just a long marriage can be that way, or any marriage can be that way. But the marriage abided, and I think it did because they both loved each other very much and were committed to each other. So for me, it was really interesting just to look into that marriage and to look at the, the choices and the consequences.
I mentioned that I'm currently reading the book and really enjoying it. It's beautifully written. That, you know, their characters are so well drawn. It's just really, it's page turning. It really is. But I found myself wondering as I'm reading it, what is fact and what isn't? And you may or may not want to answer this, but I, particularly with the kind of sexual, sensual details, I was wondering, is there really any like information of when they first like made love, for instance, or does that go into the area of recreating what might or could have happened?
Well, that goes into the area of fictionalizing, because in those days, of course, the Victorian era, people did not talk about such things.
Right.
They didn't write about such things.
Yes.
Lewis's friends found out that Lewis was sleeping with Fanny in Paris when he let a little phrase slip in which he said, her dear head upon the pillow.
Right.
Well, bingo, the word was out.
Whoops.
So this is what you're working with. And Stevenson himself said, I am so frustrated by just the narrow confines, the moral confines of Victorian society, because frankly, I would write as honestly about sex as I write, honestly about anything else, about the weather, But he said, I just can't be ahead of my age that far. I can't do that.
Interesting. Yeah, she said
yes,
that. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting, that period, because I think, previous periods, like the 18th century, I think, was a bit more open in that respect. If you look at books like Tom Jones, there was a lot more kind of visceral writing about sensuality than there was in the 19th century. So it's kind of interesting.
And then shortly after, Stevenson died in 1894, and not long after that, people, realism became very popular, and psychological novels sort of came to the fore, and I think people did write more honestly along those lines about sex. But people who knew Fanny at the time said her eyes were full of sex. She was flirtatious. She was attractive. When he met her, I can imagine how she was very sexually attracted to him. He always claimed that when he looked through the window at the Cheviot Hotel, that's when he fell in love with her. And the woman he saw through the hotel window had her feet propped on a railing of a chair that his cousin, his male cousin Bob, was sitting on. And she was talking to Bob, and she was smoking a cigarette. Hmm. Fanny was a big cigarette smoker. So, she must have looked very attractive to him, because Lewis had bohemian tastes. He would have been attracted to a pretty woman with olive skin and smoking a cigarette, and with her sort of with her feet intimately propped on the rung of a chair.
Yeah.
She was the kind of woman. She not only smoked cigarettes and rolled her own. She carried a pistol.
Right.
You know, yeah. And as I said, she lived in mining towns, and she had served barley coffee to Paiute Indians who came to her the window of her shack to talk to her. So she had a very interesting, adventurous life by the time she met Stevenson. Yeah. He would have been attracted to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly not the usual run of things, particularly for a British woman of the time. I mean, there were some interesting people, and those people figure in your novel as well, such as Fanny Sitwell, but they were the exceptions rather than the rule at that time. So,
right, absolutely.
Yeah,
Henry James makes an appearance, as you know. He's American, but he's spent so much time in Europe. And,
I was going to say, well, I think we claim him, actually. I think there's a bit of a battle. When I did my English literature degree, he was said to be a British writer.
Well, practically was, I'll admit it. And yet he loved talking to Fanny. He was a great friend of both Fanny and Lewis Stevenson. Robert Louis Stevenson's family called him Lewis, as did his friends. And, you know, that was a good thing because I think he got Fanny because he came from America.
Mm.
But also, Lewis's friends had a hard, his literary London friends had a hard time with Fanny because she arrived after they had known him for a long time, and they kind of had a boys' club.
Mm.
So someone said to me, well, she must have been like Yoko Ono. And I said, yeah, I think she was a little bit. You know, she sort of broke up the gang, and they presented her. But I also think Henry James enjoyed her thoroughly and admired her, and they had a good time.
Yeah. Well, reading the book so far has really made me want to read Stevenson again, you know, sort of go and read some of his books. I don't know if that's part of your hope for the book, that people will be like, wow, you know, it's just a whole new insight into this author.
Yes, absolutely. I think he's really worth looking at again. If you haven't looked at him for a while, you know, I would say Treasure Island is just such a delightful book to read. And it was he was considered a children's author when he published that book, and yet,
right,
you know, the Prime Minister Gladstone stayed up all night to finish that book. A lot of adults were reading that book. It has some adult seriousness to it and complex characters. Long John Silver was not all bad or all good.
Yeah.
He was considered a children's author, and then he wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And that is a dark book.
Yeah.
And I think that it surprised people that how powerfully he portrayed the duality that's possible in the human heart.
Yeah.
And that was what really made him famous. That's the thing that really catapulted him. So I think, look at Treasure Island. Read A Child's Garden of Verses to your children. He has books like Kidnapped, which is just a wonderful book.
We read that at school when I was young.
Yes, I think it's really worth it. And then his later works written in Samoa are quite interesting. His stories, Uptide, and there's a story called The Beach at Falesa, or Falesa, F-A-L-E-S-A. And, you know, you see him changing, maturing. He's really changing as a writer. That was the interesting thing about this book, was seeing how Stevenson matured as a man, as a person who lived by what he believed and stood up to, in the case of the Samoans who became his friends, to defend indigenous people who are affected by colonialization, you know, and imperialism, which was what was going on in Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very outspoken advocate for the Samoan people.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just wondering, what keeps the excitement of writing alive for you? What, you know, brings you? What brought you to this next project after the first one?
It's all about story. it's really, you know, I didn't go looking for this story. It happened, and honestly, a story has to just shake me. And this story was another story that shook me. I had actually, between the two books, I had gone out seeking an interesting woman to write about. I found a couple, and I was thinking about them, and then I bumped into this story. And first I find Stevenson, who was fascinating. And by the way, this book is told from two points of view. So it is not only a woman's point of view, as the first book was told, but it's two points of view, and you see the relationship evolve from two different perspectives.
Mm.
So first I found Stevenson living in Monterey, and I'm thinking, what is he doing there? And then I find Fanny Vandegrift Osborne, and she was such a vivid, big personality.
Mm.
And I thought, what I learned about their lives, I thought, this is it. I'm hooked.
So when you say you bumped into this story, what does that actually mean? Where are you when you bump into this? Are you in a library?
Walking,
or?
Well, I'm walking on a beach near Capitola, and
oh.
I read about this settlement of Chinese fishermen, and I'm saying,
right. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And then I went to the bookstore in Capitola, and I found a book that told about the history of Chinese fishermen in that area and told about this encampment. And in the book, I ran across a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson, and that was then the question, what's he doing here, and so forth. And then I got waylaid by that story, and I followed Stevenson.
And then you were led to Fanny through that.
That is correct. Yeah, I started then going to libraries, getting books, and reading biographies, but also then going to original materials, primary source material, reading their letters, diaries. Fanny was a diary keeper. So reading about that, reading about their times, criticism of Stevenson's works, I tried to read all of Stevenson's works, but I didn't manage to do that. But I read quite a bit.
Yeah.
And familiarized. So, you know, from his letters, I got a sense of his language. And from his work, I got a sense of his beautiful voice and his language, and he was a great writer.
Well, I would go out on a limb here to say, in my opinion, you're a great writer too, Nancy. I am really, really enjoying your book, and I appreciate
you
very much coming on this show and talking about this. And just to remind listeners once more, Nancy is in the area here, San Francisco, 22nd and 23rd, and then she is all around the country. So if you are listening on the live stream and you're in a different part of the country, you can check all that out, where she's going to appear. On her website, nancyhoran.com. So her book is called Under the Wide and Starry Sky. You can get that at all good bookshops. And her first book is called Loving Frank. So I wish you all the very best, Nancy, for your book tour. It's probably quite draining, I would think, but exciting at the same time. So
it is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's just been great talking to you.
Well, you too. And I wish you all success with this. It's a really beautiful book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. So you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. And thank you to Nancy Horan. I can't wait to get back to this book. I know I keep talking about it, but it is really good, actually. I'm holding it up to the video live stream now so you can see it. So I hope you'll join me again next week for It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland, where in the first hour we'll be looking at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, seeing if we have more in common than divides us, and in the second hour having an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. So you can follow me on Twitter at Ruth Copland. You can email me at ruth@ksco.com, and you are listening on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz. See you next week, 2 to 4 Wednesday.